when I edited together the video of the interview, you get a really good look at all your bad microphone technique.
I was going to say it's very obvious. I bet I look like I'm swatting at flies.
Yeah, pretty much.
We know the surface temperature of the Earth is warming.
Human activities are changing the atmosphere.
Simple, clear messages, repeated often by a variety of trusted voices.
It is time to forget about the old way of talking about climate change.
I'm like 97% of scientists. I can't deny it's getting hot in here.
Welcome to another episode of Evidence Squared. My name is John Cook.
I'm Peter Jacobs.
And this is part two of our interview with Robert Mack, the stand-up comedian.
Robert Mack of robertmack.com, you mean, right?
Yes. That's right, that Robert Mack. Now, last week we played part one. It was a great conversation. I really enjoyed talking with him, and it was a long conversation. So we divided it up into two parts. Also exacerbated by the fact that I tried to insert as many little clips from his show, from a Washington, D.C. comedy stand-up comedy show that he performed at.
So in part one, we kind of heard a lot about the things that, kind of good comedy is good communication. And there's a lot of things that people could take away from comedy that would help their communication. And in part two, there we actually get maybe to a little bit of the tension where there are some things about comedy that may not actually work with science communication.
Yeah, I think that as the conversation went on, I started to see similarities between what Robert Mack was describing in his approach and a lot of the techniques of misinformation and techniques that scientists do and should try to avoid. So, yeah, so that tension is interesting, and we'll come back to it, I think, after the interview.
Yeah, well, let's have a listen. We did a previous episode where we did a little bit on videos of climate humor, and we were kind of talking about different kinds of laughter and different kinds of comedy, and you've kind of mentioned that familiarity is like, you can get a laugh of recognition, a laugh of familiarity, and that's not necessarily like a funny laugh, but it's like, I get, like, I recognize that.
Yeah, there's certainly different kinds of laughs.
Can you give a couple more? John doesn't understand comedy really at all.
You don't understand comedy?
I used to be a professional funny man. So.
Okay. Yeah. There, and this is all my gut feeling on stage. I don't know if this is true, but sometimes an audience will laugh and I will think, oh, that is a laugh of recognition. Hey, do you guys remember G.I. Joe? Ah, and people go, they're not laughing because it's funny. They're laughing because they recognize it. And there's a laugh of uncomfortable, of something that's inappropriate or dark or vulgar or sexual that they shouldn't be hearing with their coworkers around.
It's like a taboo violation or something.
A taboo laugh. There's the taboo laugh might sound like that.
Ooh. Yeah.
And sometimes you'll tell a joke that is not a taboo joke and you'll get that response and you think they didn't understand it at all. And then there's the below the belt, the sexual laugh that sounds a little bit different than the intellectual laugh. And the interesting thing to me as a performer, sometimes the first laugh is the one that sets the tone for everyone else. And I don't know what the numbers are, but there are people who've studied this. In the first tenth of a second, if someone responds, then the crowd in sort of this herd mentality will respond in a similar way. So if I tell a joke that is wordplay and somebody gets offended, which is the wrong laugh, they might drag the whole audience. So the whole audience all of a sudden is going, ooh, and all I did was make a joke about Mormons and more moms, and they take it the wrong way, but...
And it's beautiful, but it's Utah, so they say it's be Utahful. Well, it's not be you, Toffo, when you're camping in a slot canyon and there's a cloudburst, flash flood, that kicked us all out. I had to get a hotel, nothing fancy, just a room in this little mom and pop and mom 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 place. Right outside Salt Lake City. Why do you think they're called Mormons?
But it's interesting. There's a whole crowd dynamic that you're dealing with as well.
So you wouldn't use that one in Utah, for instance?
No, I did use it in Utah. Oh, really? And they loved it because, and I talked to a guy about it, and he said, as Mormons, we're not in the public sphere, really. And so anytime that we're mentioned that isn't too hypercritical, we're happy.
It's just nice to be included.
It's just so nice to be included. I shot a special in Utah a couple of weeks ago, and I was very worried about that joke. And I asked a guy about it, and he said, no, just do it. And I went there that night, and the audience is full of Mormons, and you can tell, and they're not drinking, and they're young, and they're all married. And the comic before me asked, is anyone in the audience 20? And all these hands went up, and who's 20 and not married? All the hands came down. They were all young and married. They're very Mormon. And I did that joke, and it took a second, but they all loved it because it was them getting recognized. Because they don't get that recognition in the regular world.
Wow.
That's great.
But I was scared because I thought, oh, I can't go to a place and make fun of them.
Right. I'd like to go to a conference full of climate denialists and try jokes to see whether they're making jokes about us and see whether
that might be different
dynamic.
Because I'm going to bet that they're going to do the humph kind of thing where no, you've got to do something and make me change my mind. And I'm already so convinced that you won't be able to change my mind.
Do you have a tip for winning over an unreceptive audience member that we could in the same vein of the same line of thought? So when somebody's difficult to win over, what do? You move on to somebody who's more easily won over, or do you try to win them over?
That's in the old days. I would focus on them, on the 1% that isn't working, and I would try to do something. But now that I'm a little more disciplined and a little more confident, I just ignore them.
Interesting.
And deal with the 99% that I am connecting to. Because there's still that 1% who come to a comedy show and they don't want to be there. Their date dragged them there or whatever reason. Or they're in the front row going, I'm funnier than this. You think this guy's funny? I could be funnier than this. I'm not going to laugh. That's how.
No, yeah.
And I see that guy and I'm like, oh, yeah? Well, I'm going to. And now I just, whatever. If this is what you're doing tonight, yeah.
It's your money, boss.
You've decided to go out tonight and sit in the front row and go, I'm not going to laugh at a comedy show. Well, then guess what? I'm going to. Never mind, you're wasting your time, and I'll deal with everyone else.
Do you know any comedian that's ever planted someone in the audience to laugh, to do that whole herd mentality thing?
I was at a show once and I was the middle act, and the first act was very weird. It was two guys, and I think their name was the Whistleros. There were two guys who whistled. And they would do songs and sing little songs through whistling. And it was very weird at a comedy show. I'd never seen it. But it was at a big theater, so it felt very theatrical. And the crowd, because it's a large place, the crowd's spread out. And you want, for comedy, you want intimacy. And nobody wanted to sit up front, and the crowd was all over. So the woman who produced the show sat in the front, and she would laugh, ha ha. It just kind of this ha ha, and it got people engaged, and they would sort of join in, and there's a herd, and you can't explain it until you see it, right. And it's a psychological thing, and so they all started laughing, and then you know she got up and went away and said, you know, I sparked them and they ignited, and the show went on from there.
I wonder if you can do that with science talk. You could have someone in the front row saying, "Well explained."
Well played, sir. Right.
We talked in the previous climate comedy episode about laugh tracks, and and the effect of laugh tracks and how...
There's a reason for that.
Right. They work.
They work. That's why they've used them.
There's another way, a great idea I thought of. Huge ceiling fans in the desert outside. I don't know how they'll attach. But big ceiling fans outside will vent all the hot air up and create shade for everybody underneath. Yeah, I just killed two birds with one stone because that's how I roll. I'm Robert Mack and I kill birds. Okay?
I feel like... I mean, the stuff I would want to know about would be what could we take away from comedy to give to people who have to communicate their science? And it, like this, I guess we've covered a bit of it, which is like, how do you kind of right size the knowledge level of your audience and
be specific and try to be emotional if you can.
Right.
And again, if science is all intellectual, try to find an emotional, something that counterpoints that so they could see the big picture of it. Like that 700 million joke turns into something about something completely different that's more emotional and real than these facts and numbers and figures, which are more empirical and scientific and cold in a way. I think if you connect with someone on an emotional level, they're more likely to remember it. And I think that's how comedy works, is you can talk about any topic, and because you're hitting people in two different places, they're more likely to remember whatever you're talking about. And they're more open to hearing more about it.
Your process, I'm inferring this from what you were saying. It sounds like you kind of, something strikes you as funny, then you kind of set about writing the joke. Is that more or less?
Yeah.
Some people think that like people who are funny are just funny and they're not a funny person, so they're not going to try. But I know just from, you know, kind of osmosis that people actually spend a lot of time working on their jokes. So like you don't have to be, and maybe nobody is, like just an amazing comedian. Everything's spontaneous.
There are some guys who are funny off the stage. I'm not one of them, and I just came from a couple of meetings, which is why I have a tie on. Just for the people at home, I have a tie on because I was at some meetings. And those people have never seen me perform, and they all know that I'm a comedian, but they have no idea.
Are they like, really? He's a comedian?
He doesn't seem funny. Yeah. Well, I'm off the clock. And right. There are some comics who, when they're off the clock, like myself, we're serious and we get our job done and we have to write jokes and we have to research jokes and put the facts down. And that's one side. And there are other comics who are just goofballs all the time. Hey, look at me. And they need attention, maybe.
Right.
And so that's why they're doing that. But if you want people to follow the process of what you're saying, you have to write a clear, logical joke. So there are logical steps. And like I said, you have to clear the fat out. And so it's a flow chart to get from something that everyone has acknowledged or understood to something specific that is funny or interesting or different or unique or weird or I don't understand it. And that's the writing process for me.
I get a weather alert, tornado warning, or hail or possibly snow. I can't believe this weather because I'm an atheist and we have trouble believing, but it's not as bad as my neighbor. He's agnostic. He doesn't know whether or not we have weather or not.
Do you find that people, there's this kind of this concept in communication where like, if you trigger a question in people's brains and then you close that loop for them, it's like immensely rewarding. Is that?
That's what a joke is.
Yeah.
A joke is something that it's two paths that cross, and that little pivot is the joke, and the punchline fulfills both of those trains of thought. And so you need an example. You need,
well, that's two paths that cross. Can you flesh that out?
My friend has a. This is my friend's example, and I just want to make sure I don't get it right, but something about I took my dad out for his birthday, and I forget how she words it, but like I shot him straight through the head. But it was, she took him out, right, which means two different things.
Right.
So it means to go out and be social, but it also means to kill somebody. And so where the punchline fulfills both of those expectations, And that's what comedy does. You set up a joke and it leads people to have one thought that's going this way. And there's a left turn, and that left turn is that pivot point is usually the word that you can have a play on words or a pun. And that is the thing that pivots the joke to a different direction. So that different direction isn't what you thought was happening, but it still fulfills
right. The
obligation that was established in the beginning of the joke.
You're confounding expectations, but you're fulfilling something about the original. So it's not, you're not going off in a completely absurdist direction.
I'm not going absurdist, which is a whole different leg or branch of comedy. But so wording in my particular form of comedy, and there's a lot of different kinds of comedy. There's physical comedy, which you don't have to have any words at all. And there's guys who are more into ideas, and my act is more about the wording has to be this.
Right.
So I'm setting up a word here, which leads to this word so that the audience thinks this, but that word also means this. And so when I go here, they're tricked, and that trick is the aha, which is the ha-ha, which is the laugh.
I'm a big fan of science. I follow it religiously.
And I guess when I talk to scientists about science communication and I talk about the characteristic of sticky messages, and unexpectedness is one of those sticky elements. So if you can take people by surprise.
Yeah, if you can take them by that's what keeps people on the edge of their seat. If you knew what jokes were coming, comedy wouldn't be funny. But my act, I try to get people to lean in and listen because they don't know where it's going to go. And the best compliment I ever got was a comedian who said, you know, I've been doing this for, you know, over a decade and I've heard every joke in the book, but I had to follow you and listen because every word determines where this path is going and what the potential could be. Are we going this way? Or are we going to make a complete, you know, 180 and go the opposite direction? And that's what I love, is to get people to go, oh, where is this going? I have no idea where this is going. And that's all by the your word choice. It's poetry in a way. It's a lot of picking exactly what lexicon and what diction you want to use to get people to trick them to think that you're going right and you go left.
Thanks for coming tonight. I know you didn't have to. You could have stayed in and turned your brain off and stuck your head in front of that rectangle. The endless parade of changing characters that turns your brain into mush, right? Stupid books.
I don't know how scientists can do that, though. I guess when I talk about it in a scientific context, usually I use examples where you give them, you know, scientific facts that are counterintuitive or that take them by surprise, like global warming is happening at a rate of 4 atomic bombs per second. And people are like, wow, it's that much? Like, that's how much heat's building up? Mm. And so that takes people by surprise. Or just telling them that 97% of climate scientists agree that humans are causing global warming. And a lot of people think, really? I thought it was like a 50-50 or maybe 60-70%. Mm. I didn't realize it was that high. I mean, that's not exactly gut busting stuff.
No, I'm not laughing at all.
No, it's not. But
you could use those. You could work them into a joke.
It's the principle of taking people by surprise more than like not everything has to be a joke necessarily.
I would say that there's a lot of magic in comedy where it's misdirection, where you're getting people to look at the red hanky over here, but actually it's the left hanky over here that is where the action is happening. And again, it's weird that, not weird, but it's interesting that in the science community or in the world of science, it's not about misdirection. It's about clarity and being precise and open and honest and transparent as possible. So comedy in science has to be.
It's almost like
it's almost impossible.
They're at counter purposes.
Yeah. Yeah. They
cross purposes.
Very difficult.
When I use the metaphor of the magician and the misdirection, usually we're talking about misinformation and the way that
and deceit.
Like, yeah, right. like
anti-science,
like rhetorical tricks or logical fallacies are used to you know, distract people from the facts or
but look at this mislead. Over here, and which is what our current administration, I think, is doing.
Yeah, so I'm trying to decide whether you are the enemy or not.
No, no, no. I'm a friend, but I'm just a friend on with a different skill set.
Right.
And again, it's the expectations of the audience. If they're all scientists, they're going to want their proofs spelled out, and something that is trickery or deceit or deceiving or left turns, or they might not accept that as in the same way, which is why instead of trying to be funny yourselves, just have one joke in the beginning, one joke at the end, and hire a comedian to close the show.
Or like the jokes don't have to be about the science. So this is a conversation that I've had because like I'm a DC person, and like so politics is like our sports because our sports teams are terrible. And like there's an old adage that like if you're explaining, you're losing.
Right.
That's like a Ronald Reaganism. And like
if you have to explain a joke, the joke hasn't done
better. And then it's like, or if you're you can teach the audience something along the way, but if you're trying to teach the audience two things, if you're trying to get people to follow you in two different ways at once, like that's impossible. And so
one
like,
at a time.
Right. If you're trying to set up a joke where they've got to follow you for your joke, but that also requires them to kind of think about science or process scientific information, that might be at cross purposes, or that might be setting you up for failure. But the jokes can come like as transitions from like, here's science point A, you can do comedy, do science point B, you can do, it doesn't have to be, the jokes don't have to be the science.
Right, right. The punchline doesn't have to be global warming. It can be anything along the way.
They're the breadcrumbs that get you to the punchline.
Right, right. Yeah, they're the breadcrumbs. Exactly. That's a good way of looking at it. Make that the filler. All right, and here's another true scientific important point. You make that. And then here's a joke about that. And here's a joke about our next topic. And here's another joke. And now here's the next topic. And we're serious about that. So you can intersperse it and make sure that it's clear that the points you're making are honest and true and not deceiving and not trying to be deceitful. And I think an audience of scientists would be smart enough to figure that out.
Those animals, I'm sorry, those animals were going to die anyway. Just like in the old days, the dinosaurs, they died. And just like in the future, we're going to die. All right, we don't want to live forever. Trust me, where do you think you're going to live? You see how crowded it's now? Where do you think you're going to live if everybody could live forever? All right, it's just, and I'm glad those dinosaurs died. You know why? That's where we got the oil in the first place, all right? Black gold, Texas T-Rex.
I'd be interested in your thoughts on this thought. One of the ways I think that comedy can really inform people and even improve their critical thinking skills is using analogies to expose misleading techniques and fallacies. So like, for example, there's a number of comedy videos on YouTube where they take like climate denial arguments and then translate them into real life. Like people use the same kind of arguments they would use about climate change. What happens when they use those same arguments in everyday,
Analogies are a great tool of comedy as well, because they put it into a venue or format that people can relate to more, because we can't relate to the globe warming up so many degrees. But yeah, you change the language to make it something that's more relatable. That's exactly what comedy is being able to relate.
I guess the source of the funniness too is its exaggeration. Like those ridiculous arguments, when you see them in real life, you realize how ridiculous they are. So you get a laugh and you learn.
You teach a point. I think if you can teach a point and get someone to laugh at it, that reinforces the whatever they've learned.
We struggle a little bit kind of trying to find comedy that is funny in a way that won't be off-putting to a broad audience, because you don't, like you were kind of mentioning earlier, like you don't want to get people's backs up and make them feel like they're the ones being made fun of. Like you can have people recognize themselves and laugh, and that's good, but if they feel like they're the butt of the joke, you might lose them.
True.
And so just like, are there other ways, are there other pitfalls you could look out for and like how to not like piss off your audience?
Don't insult the audience. Make fun of yourself. I make fun of myself, and people laugh, and it warms them up because now they're laughing and they realize it's okay to laugh. And I've won them over. I don't want to say charming, but I've by them laughing at me, I'm not the butt of a joke, but I kind of am, but it's okay to laugh at me, and I've sort of set that groundwork.
My brain is so dense with ideas, I don't want to make it sound like I'm bragging, but I'm probably the densest person in this room. In fact, one of America's smartest doctors is so interested in my great ideas, she interviews me every week in her office for nearly an hour. During our last interview session, she calls them sessions because they're obviously like music to her ears. I call them obsessions because she writes down everything that I say. She asks me, Robert Mack from robertmack.com. If your house were on fire and you could only remove one thing, what would it be? And as always, there are no right or wrong answers. And I said, well, I'd probably remove the fire.
So if you could be self-deprecating, I find that's a very simple tool and very effective tool at letting people know it's okay to laugh.
And also that you're not condescending to them.
And I'm not condescending to them. I've been called condescending years ago. I've been called aloof and condescending. And I think it was just because I was on stage and I was smart, and people in the audience don't appreciate that when they realize that they're not as smart. And so my act became this dumb guy who's self-deprecating, and that is the niche that I found myself in. And it's a technique. It's a strategy that's worked for me for many years. And I'm very thankful that I've discovered this sort of stupid character who thinks he's smart, but is able to say stupid things and say some smart things as well. And the audience buys some of it, and some of it they have to question, and it makes them figure things out on their own.
I happen to know a lot of stuff, all right? I didn't graduate from the University of Arizona with a degree in international studies at all. But
were there any public figures that you based that character on?
Any public figures?
Yeah, you know, maybe
or
a governor.
Personal life. I mean,
yeah. No, but
maybe a governor from Alaska or something.
No. But when I go back and look, one of the first comedians I really liked was Steve Martin.
Right, he did a lot, yeah.
And he was very just. I'm so smart and funny, and he would say something that totally kicks himself in the face. Right. So, I don't think I started with that, but I think years of trying different things, it became this sort of, and there are many comedians who've played this sort of braggadocious idiot character that is, and some comedians might not think this is legit. It's safe in a way because I'm not making fun of you or those idiots watching. I'm making fun of myself, and it's not risk taking in that way. It's not, questioning society, and it's not doing some of these renegade things that comedy is supposed to do, but it gets laughs.
It's not like 90s leather jacket ranting.
Right.
Comedy.
Right. Exactly. It's, but it's getting laughs and it's entertaining. Mm-hmm. And if I can get people to think and get people to be aware of climate change or whatever event I'm doing, then sure. Why not? Why not do that? And like I said, I think I have a voice, and that character fits into that, and it's hard to change.
I love magic ever since I was a little kid, and my dad disappeared. Abracadad gone.
Once you start with that voice, like you, even if that's not you as like a real person, like that character has to be authentic. Like you has to be consistent, right? You can't switch that character midstream.
Exactly. Like there are many characters in comedy from Rodney Dangerfield. I mean, he wasn't a loser the way he portrays on stage, but that's his voice and that's his character, and he sticks with that. So, right.
Yeah.
My character is a bit of a loser and a bit of a self, full of himself kind of guy, like an early Steve Martin, and it works for me.
Right.
Different comedians have found different ways to present their material.
Does the jerk work as a character? Because I think that's what Peter's been going for since we started this podcast.
The jerk?
Yeah.
Not the Steve Martin jerk, but just
a
jerk.
No, not the movie. Just the jerk.
Just the jerk. There are some comedians who have a...
It works when there's two people, because I can be the jerk and then...
But you were talking right. earlier about, oh, and his name escapes me with the leather jacket and the.
Oh, I didn't name any
Dennis
names.
Leary.
I didn't want to insult anybody's personal heroes.
No. It's not a hero, but I forgot his name.
Which one? Because there was a few of them during that. You talking about Dennis
Dickory
Leary?
Duck.
Oh, Andrew Dice Clay.
Andrew Dice Clay was a jerk.
Right,
and
right.
And it was a character, but some people thought it was so authentic that they you know, boycotted him. But that's a character, and it's a character that had a consistent voice.
Right.
And it was a jerk, and some people loved it.
Right.
And some people didn't, but. There's always going to be some people who don't like the character that you play or the message that you're trying to.
Yeah. You like me.
But authenticity, I think it's like that. It's like a paradox. It's authenticity about a fake or not fake, but it's authenticity about your not true self. Yeah. Yeah.
Consistency.
Yeah.
It's a character, but I'm consistent with the character.
Right.
I've got a problem thinking right now. It's called Operation Chill Off, which is what everyone needs to do. Just chill off. That's what my mom, Pat, always says to me, because sometimes it gets too hot in the basement for me to sleep. But I didn't come here tonight to talk about Pat because she's not the boss of me.
The more specific a group gets, whether it's science or sports, the more specific the lingo gets.
Hmm.
And sometimes it's hard to speak to someone not in your group because they have a different they have a different word for everything.
Right.
Or they have a different set of expectations. And you were mentioning sports. I'm not a sports guy, but I saw that the local hockey team, which are called the Capitals.
Right. You got it.
Because it's all about money, capital. The Capitalists are in the playoffs or were in the playoffs. I haven't followed up recently.
I think they've pushed to... They were about to get eliminated, and they've come back.
Well, I was reading the sports page just to follow what was going on, and the sports writers were so certain that they knew who was reading the article that they didn't give basic facts.
Yeah.
So I didn't know if this was a 3-game series or a 5-game series or a 7-game series, and that information wasn't in the first 3-4 paragraphs of the story because – they were sports people speaking to sports people, and scientists who speak to scientists might not have the right language or skills to speak to someone in the lay community. So if a scientist wants to talk about global warming and they're talking to a non-scientific audience and they use lingo about, you know, like metric or whatever, something that's outside their world, then it might not resonate. So I wrote down notes about a specific audience has a specific language, and when you're trying to talk to people not in that world, you're gonna have trouble communicating because it's a different language, like this guy here with the words that sound like you're from south of the equator.
Or like sticky, like I take sticky. It for granted that and like I'm not even a social scientist, it's just like I forget that that's not a commonly
when we talk about sticky science and sticky communication, that's a word that we've been using amongst ourselves for the last few years. It doesn't even occur to us that
to me, sticky refers to a post on a website that is always near the top because it's has basic information that people need. But a sticky situation is
That's right. It's bad.
Yeah, I don't want to get in a sticky situation.
And we've been struggling with this with the podcast too, like this curse of knowledge, because we inhabit.
Is that
this
what you
world.
Call it, the curse of knowledge?
Yeah.
Okay. All right.
And so we live in this world, and we. Even when we're consciously trying to speak to a lay audience or just people who aren't familiar with the stuff that we're trying to communicate, we kind of just sort of fall into these old habits, I think.
Yeah. Because your day is surrounded by people who speak your lingo. And when you step out of that world, you don't know what sticky means to someone who isn't a scientist because you don't spend any time outside of science. So
well,
that's another
issue. Also, people are kind of non-confrontational, so it's rare that somebody would be like, you're saying things that are going over my head. Like people don't like to say when
people
I go,
don't like to admit that they're stupid.
Well, no, not even stupid. Like if I go to a different scientific, like I'm in, you know, climate of the ancient past kind of stuff, but I go to talks on, like, you know, the how clouds change with climate change, and like that is completely, even though it's related, it's completely foreign to me in some ways. And like, I don't stop people and say, you're saying something I don't understand. I'm like, uh-huh. And so they're like, good. I'm good. Like I'm right at the general audience level that I should be. And like, you know, shame on me for not being like, that's unclear.
So maybe if we could rewind and go back, that would be step number one, is to know what is the terminology in your field that the general public doesn't have.
I mean, we're constantly kind of talking about how are scientists really bad communicators, or like, do scientists become bad communicators through just kind of like by training, because they're constantly, there's a pressure to just speak in lingo, and there's a pressure to like, you have to write journal articles in a like a passive voice, and you can't use metaphor, you can't use colorful language, like,
oh, that's,
it just,
right,
all,
yeah,
of the,
you
stuff gets,
it has
squeezed,
to be as
it's
clear,
the most
precise,
bloodless.
And when I wrote my PhD dissertation, I decided, all right, I'm going to write something interesting. And I put all these little anecdotes in it and tried to make it. Oh, yeah. All that stuff went in the first draft.
And that's in for like psychology, which is like, if you're going to get away with that, maybe you got a shot.
Maybe. But in the real sciences, no offense.
Right.
But in the real sciences,
he gets it.
That's one of the things we're trying to dispel in this podcast, is social science is a real science.
You sound defensive, John.
I found the weak link.
Yeah,
his
yeah. Well, he was actually a brilliant physicist, or budding physicist.
Brilliant budding.
And gave it all up to become a cartoonist.
Wow.
Right. And then I went down a notch even further and became a cognitive psychologist.
Yeah.
Oh, is that a step lower?
Oh, yeah. That's way below.
Have you had any cartoonists on here?
We'd love to.
Absolutely, we'd love to.
All right.
Well, if you know any.
Someone who does science
communication. You know who Tom Tolles is? He does Washington Post.
I don't know him, but I like his work, and yeah. I followed his work for years. Very funny.
Well, he co-did a book with a climate scientist.
Really?
Because he does climate change all the time.
Well, yeah, and a lot of political stuff.
Yeah. Obviously. And Mike Mann is the climate scientist, and he did the illustration. It's called like the Madhouse Effect, I think. And so hypothetically, we will get him. At some point.
We're working on it.
But
wow. Yeah. Well, I'll be there for that.
Yeah.
Where the audience sits in these empty chairs?
I think Peter's dream is to do a live podcast one day up on the stage with these adoring fans. And
both of them, yes.
But if you wanted to do a live podcast to give a demonstration of a scientific bit, hello, you can have a bunch of science comedians up there.
Yeah. I mean, it would be interesting to like say, this is the kind of stuff we'd like to talk about. How would you guys do it? And see how
it would be an interesting dynamic on stage. Scientists and comedians. It would be kind of like the comedians would rev the audience up, and then the scientists would put them to sleep, and then
they'd be like the ER doctors, just constantly resuscitating. Yeah.
But there's more than that. The scientists fulfill an important role, and they know that about themselves, and they know that their work is important. But yeah, I think they're humble. I do a lot of corporate shows, and when I do shows for surgeons or doctors, I can't do anything that makes fun of them.
Really?
Because of their egos. They have big egos.
Mm. Yeah.
But most other audiences and scientists seem to laugh at themselves, you know, for not getting something or being oblivious or being the absent-minded professor types. But there are certain professions that you can't do that.
That's interesting. I wonder if that's like you have to have that. I mean, this isn't like to be funny. I wonder if like, if you have to believe that much in yourself and be like that ego driven, because if you stopped and thought, I have a knife in somebody's brain right now, what am I doing?
I don't think it's necessary to get into it, but I think years of reinforcement make them all think, oh, we're the top of the food chain.
Yeah.
And, I have a throwaway line that I do on stage when I get into a bit about travel. I just say to the audience, you know, I travel a lot because I'm better than you.
I travel a lot because I'm better than you. I was traveling through Oklahoma to get to a better place. But I was driving ahead of Oklahoma. Yeah, it's nothing like the musical, is it? I did not have fun there at all. There was a lot of booing going on during my presentation, and I'm sorry, but a crowd has to be really, really stupid for me to boo them.
And most audiences just kind of realize, he's lying. He's an idiot. He's full of himself. But certain medical professionals, surgeons, take offense
at that joke
that I'm making fun of them.
Right.
Oh,
right,
wow.
Right.
It is so you, weird.
You paint this sort of ugly picture and they say, hey, wear that ugly picture.
Well, it's just I've learned not to do that joke for those audiences anymore because they're so full of themselves that they misinterpret the intent of that line.
Yeah.
And the intent of that line is I say something stupid and that is completely not believable. And most people see that, but they do not because they're full of themselves and maybe defensive about
right.
it.
Right. Yeah.
Because every profession has, there are certain traits that are either cause people to get into that profession or come to the fore after years of doing it. Right. And I'm sure that there's a common thread in scientists. I'm sure that specific fields of science have certain common characteristics.
You're talking about physicists. Yeah. When you're all that stuff about surgeons, that's physicists.
Oh, I mean, I think there's a general consensus within the scientific community that physicists are jerks.
And they think that they're
yes.
the top?
Yes.
I mean,
yes.
Physicists will say that physics is the only science and everything else is stamp collecting.
Everything else is soft science.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then who's at the bottom? In their mind, who's at the bottom?
There's a XKCD cartoon, I think, that – well, I think at the – in the pecking order, I think mathematicians were even above physicists, right?
Right.
And I think social scientists were right at the other end of the spectrum.
Psychologists, in fact.
Was it psychologists? Bastard.
They're the worst.
For many years, it was just science men. And then they said, fine, we'll allow a science lady. And the first science lady was Marie Curie, who's the only person to win two different Nobel Prizes in two different fields of science. And she discovered radiation. And she discovered the only substance harder than diamonds, it's an avocado from Trader Joe's.
So, you want to give a plug for robertmack.com, maybe to the camera or something?
Sure, sure. Come, you can get clips and find out where I'm performing at robertmack.com, and sign up for my email so I can let you know when I'm going to be in your neck of the woods. And thanks for listening.
I have a bit of a confession. I had some fake news in that. Towards the end there.
You were giving us misinformation during the interview.
Yeah, the XKCD cartoon, it is not psychologists at the low end of the totem pole.
Right.
It's sociologists because sociology is just applied psychology. So, mea culpa there.
Okay. Do psychologists appear in the cartoon?
Oh, yeah. I mean, they're second to the worst. That I wasn't completely... You're still really far down on the totem pole. Don't worry.
But we're not last, and I think I'll take that.
Yeah.
But it seems to be a recurring theme. Like I think that Aaron Cass was dissing social science as well. And so
yeah, I got to tell you, man, you got to get some thicker skin about this.
What I think I need to get is better PR for my field of science.
Yeah. I think probably too many people just think it's all laying down on the couch and Freud and cocaine and mother complexes. So I definitely think you could use some.
Well, that's what this podcast is about.
Yeah. So there was a lot of good content in this part as well. I mean, right off the bat, I thought it was interesting. The Mormon joke to Mormons was that I kind of was not really expecting him to talk about how that joke went over so well, but then after he did, I was like, oh, you know, I mean, I kind of got it. Like, I think that there are times when you see something of yourself in a TV show or in a movie, even if it isn't particularly flattering, and it's just like, hey, you know, like that's me or that's us, and it's fun to be included.
It reminded me of a conversation I had with an American a number of years ago when we were in Australia. An American married my best friend, and she was kind of like me now in that she was a stranger in a strange land. She was the foreigner living in Australia, and she was giving us her perspective of Australians. And she said that whenever in the world Australia got mentioned,
Australians all reacted like, oh, wow, they're talking about us. That's exciting. Right. And she just thought that was so quaint and cute in a kind of a condescending American kind of way.
I have had Canadian friends who have said the same thing to me.
So, yeah, I mean, that was an interesting perspective. The other interesting perspective I didn't see coming was medical doctors as an audience.
Surgeons. As the physicist of the medical community. I mean, that's such a cliche. I'm surprised you didn't know about that.
What, physicists being jerks? Or surgeons being jerks?
Surgeons being like the god complex and they have no humor about themselves and they can't stand to be belittled.
It doesn't surprise me. And I have, well, I've seen that dynamic, not with surgeons, but with other people. I've done a joke that's, I guess, insulting a certain type of behavior without mentioning any group or anyone. But then people take offense at it because they see themselves in that.
Yeah. I have a dear uncle who has kind of he's got a lot of comedic timing, but he does like this Rodney Dangerfield-esque thing. And he says, I resemble that remark. So the one other thing, I can just throw this out here just because it's somewhat interesting. We kind of kicked off the episode this part of the interview talking about different types of laughter. And there's actually a pretty interesting TED talk by somebody, neuroscientist. I think her name is Sophie Scott. And we can put a link to that in the show notes just in case anybody's kind of interested in the sort of that whole idea of laughter being contagious, planting laughter, like people laugh as a sort of a social bonding, social contagion phenomenon.
So she's talking about like actual sort of research.
It's like the physical and mental processes that kind of are happening.
I was interested in just the timing. I think he said something like a tenth of a second is the, you know, such a short little period of time in order to kind of establish, I guess, that sort of social, I guess, to have that laughter propagate through a room. It's just that fast thinking, that kind of instantaneous reaction that humans have. It's amazing how quickly it operates.
So it's that sort of system one versus system two thought process or reaction. And we haven't really gotten into that specifically, but maybe we can do a whole episode about that later. But there's sort of the sort of, you know, quick reactive emotional
yeah, we definitely should do an episode on that, because a better understanding of system one versus system two, or fast versus slow thinking, is really crucial to understanding how people think and how people respond to information, and therefore how we should communicate. So for a future episode, if you could get hold of Daniel Kahneman as an interview subject, that'd be great.
Oh, sure. I'm sure that'll be super easy. He's not totally in demand. I think
it couldn't be any harder than
right
getting Catherine Hayhoe as an interview subject.
But sort of kind of on that topic of the, you know, we're just saying system one and system two, and we're, you know, we're kind of elaborating on that. But that's something that we don't normally define, you know, when we're just talking to people, I think even when we talk to physical scientists, and that's sort of shame on us, because that's another one of those sort of jargony things that makes sense to us because it's something we're so familiar with. And we sort of hit that in this part of the interview, just that whole idea of the curse of knowledge, of assumed knowledge and jargon.
Yeah. I mean, Robert talked a lot about knowing your audience and tailoring your content based on their knowledge levels. And it's something that scientists need to do as well.
Yeah, so that goes to the comedy and science communication sort of working in the same direction. But then there were, as you mentioned, there are some things where it almost seems like comedy and science, if not science communication, are sort of working in opposite directions, because comedy, you know, a lot of time relies on setting up and thwarting expectations or misdirection or
exaggeration.
Yeah, exaggeration. A lot of these things you're not a trusted source in terms of a factual nature, that you really, that's sort of the bread and butter of a scientist facing the public. And also some of you know, the content of science is not necessarily the best for jokes. And I thought, you know, we discussed that a little bit, and it seemed like, you know, he thought that you could get through that, or you could get around that, because you don't have to make the scientists joke about their science. The science doesn't have to be the joke. The scientists don't necessarily have to be providing all the comedy. You know, a scientist could work with a comedian, that sort of thing.
Yeah, I think he was working towards trying to get more gigs.
Yeah, well, no, I mean, wouldn't it be great? You were like making fun of me about wanting to do like a live show. It would be great to do. I don't know what kind of crowd size we could get, but I would love to do a podcast with sort of an audience and with Robert and maybe some other science comedians.
If you can get Daniel Kahneman as an interview guest, then I think we'll be at the point where I'll organize a live show for the next episode after that.
That's how we'll know that we have the audience size for that.
Now, I mentioned in the interview how I used to be a professional funny man. I used to do cartooning for a living. And part of that was I used to run humor workshops with kids. I would basically teach them how to write jokes and draw cartoons, but basically how to write cartoons, how to write funny situations. And really the basic principle that I would explain to them was taking the normal world and then flipping it or exaggerating it or surprising people or just doing something unexpected. And it really, I mean, that's really what Robert Mack was talking about, was the ideas of exaggerating and defeating expectations. And science is the opposite of that, right? It's about understanding exactly how the world works. It's not
right, but I mean, sure, but it, you know, a lot of the stuff that we know because of science is counter to people's preconceptions. Like that's one of the reasons why we have science, is because sort of your gut level thinking about something or your superficial knowledge of something isn't necessarily the right answer. And it's only through really careful, hard scientific study that you can arrive at, you know, the right answer. And that's not always what we expect it to be.
And when I do give science communication talks and I go through the six traits of sticky, compelling science messages, and I look at unexpected messages as one way of making science stickier, I talk about how if you're trying to explain a counterintuitive concept to people, embrace that. Like, embrace the counterintuitiveness. Don't look at that as something that's to be afraid of when you're explaining to people. Rather, try to take that unexpected element of your research and take people by surprise with it, and that will make the science stickier.
Right, absolutely. I think that there are people who are worried or concerned that their research doesn't translate well to the public because it doesn't align with what people might expect to be true, and that absolutely does not have to be a flaw. It can absolutely be a benefit.
The only other way that I could really sort of reconcile Robert's descriptions of comedy and science communication was, and I mentioned this in the interview, was through debunking misinformation. And I think that we looked at some videos back in our Emily Braga episode of using analogies to debunk misinformation by taking climate denialist claims and translating them into real-life situations just to show how ridiculous they are.
Right, right. And I think he said something like, you know, that's what comedy is. Comedy is about translating things into from something unfamiliar to something very relatable.
Mm.
And I think that absolutely can work for communicating, work for debunking, you know, bad communication and misinformation.
The other thing that I think debunking does powerfully as a communication technique is that idea of creating gaps in people's minds and then filling them. Because what you're doing is you're saying, here's the facts, here is a myth, there's a conflict between the two. And
right.
and that creates a gap. People are like, how can there be these two conflicting pieces of information? And then you resolve the conflict. You explain the fallacy in the myth, or how that myth came about in the first place, or why people promote that myth. And that fills the gap. It closes people's understanding. And so from a storytelling point of view, that I think is a powerful form of communication.
The thing that comedy does, and the thing that science communicators would be well advised to do, is to make that. It's not enough to make that gap. You have to. Something has. It also has to be interesting. It has to be concrete. It has to be there. It can't just be, hey, something you know is wrong. So there's got to be a little spice to it.
And I guess that show don't tell is a good technique for achieving that. Trying to come up with creative ways to paint your conclusion. Without just saying it in a simple, obvious way.
Right.
So I got there. I was looking for practical tips and and techniques, and I feel like there are some things that I can take hold of and try to apply practically from this.
From this one and from the previous interview episode as well.
Yeah, that's right. And it's just great to listen to. Like He's very engaging. He's very insightful, but hilarious all the way through as well.
We have done some pretty fun interviews, and you know, that might be the nerd in me saying that some of the other interviews were fun. This one was genuinely fun to do. It was very, very enjoyable and entertaining just to hang out with him and listen to him kind of riff.
Hopefully we can get some more people of his ilk, whether it be cartoonists or I don't know, other people in the artistic world. I think they've got a lot to offer.
what do you mean cartoonists? Is that Tom Tolles?
Well, yeah, him. I don't know anyone else off the top of my head.
Every time you talk about cartooning in the context of like things being very funny, I don't even know if you have this in Australia, but there's something called like the family circus.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, but that's like this sort of like old stage 60s cartoon, right?
That's what I imagine you're talking about.
No, God, no. I mean, I grew up with that, and I hated it when I was a kid.
No, I know. It's like the worst of the worst.
So that's this week's episode. Well, if there's any links, I think we've talked about a few things that we'll include in the show notes. You can find our show notes at evidencesquared.com on our website.
You can find us on Twitter at Evidence Squared and Facebook at Evidence Squared.
You can also like and share us and rate us on iTunes.
Right. And you can email me at peter@evidencesquared.com.
And email me at john@evidencesquared.com.
And we will talk to you next time.
See you later.
Did we cover everything? I want to make sure.
I feel like, well, we covered everything I wanted to talk about. Yeah,
I mean, we covered everything we were going to ask about in the first 5 minutes. So. Yeah. Oh, we were, yeah.
There were some other things. Can I look at my notes
real
quick?
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah, sure. Hold on.
He's more prepared than we are. That's...
No, I wrote some answers down because I thought...
Peter doesn't actually believe in preparation. I think he has a kind of a philosophical problem with it.
I do.